Welcome, history friends, patrons all, to Poland Is Not Yet Lost, episode 17. So there I was, sitting on my very comfy chair on a lovely Sunday afternoon and thinking to myself, what a lovely day. And then I kind of got this sinking feeling when I realized that a new episode of Poland Is Not Yet Lost is due, and I hadn't done anything about it. It's been a really crazy past few months. I think that between everything with the PhD and things being due and having to apply for funding, I've really had to push the podcast to the wayside a lot. Of course, I've also been busy with getting the book out there, and the last few weeks I've been releasing all those episodes to introduce people to the 30 Years' War, and that's gone very well, and we've had new people joining up and listening and everything else, which is fantastic. But I don't want you guys, you great Patreon supporters, to feel like you've been abandoned. And a final reminder, if you want to get 10 months for the price of 12 on Patreon, then head on over and sign up for an annual membership now. You can, of course, upgrade your membership or decrease your membership or whatever you want to do. It's up to yourselves. I have been asked whether or not I prefer it being annual or monthly, or which one gives me more or less money, and I really do appreciate that. It's so lovely to see you guys just basically choosing the option that gives me more money. To be honest, at this very moment in my life, with all the bills that are due, I am in need of ready cash. So that's why I've been saying please do sign up for the annual ones, but please don't feel compelled to do so if you've no interest in doing so. Suit yourself, and as long as you're supporting this show, honestly, I will not complain. I have no cause to complain. You've all been fantastic, and I couldn't do the PhD without you, because all the money I've been getting over the last few weeks from the special offer over September has gone straight to the PhD and to sending the books out as well. A little note on the books. I know those of you who have bought it are probably really, really impatient at this stage, and rightfully so. And some of you have also reasonably asked me why it is that when you bought it, I still haven't sent it. The reason for that is really quite straightforward, and it's, once again, all my fault. You see, when I was selling you the signed copies of the books a year ago, or 2 years ago, or even a few months ago, I didn't realize how big the book was going to be, or how heavy the book was going to be, or how expensive it would be to send abroad. So because of that, I undercharged you on a ridiculous level. This isn't me saying poor me, and it's not me asking for more money. Really, it's just me trying to explain why it's taking so long. Because to send you a book, if I was to send it from Ireland to America, for instance, it would cost 20 euro. If I was to send it to the UK or Europe, it would cost about 15, which is still quite a lot of money. If you multiply that by about 150, which is about the amount of signed copies I'm having to send off, then you can see the task in front of me. I'm getting through them gradually, but I do appreciate that patrons particularly are getting impatient, and I'm just very sorry about that. It makes me very upset and very embarrassed that I can't just send all those books in one go. So that's another reason why having all you annual guys sign up and just injecting loads of cash into my bank account, that's why that's good, because I can put that cash not just towards college fees, but also towards book costs, which is all very nice and all very helpful indeed. So thank you all very much for that, and that concludes our housekeeping for today. So now we're going to try and transition into this latest episode of Poland Is Not Yet Lost. I know it's been a while since we were last in this narrative and in this story, but if you're anything like me, then it won't matter all that much to you, because you're just here for the history after all. So let's try and do our best to pick up where we left off last time. And last time, to jog our memories, we continued our analysis of the diplomacy between 1716 to 1720, with a focus on 1719 in particular, and the Georgian peace initiatives, which aimed at isolating Russia and putting steel into the Polish-Lithuanian Commonwealth so that a northern league would result. As we saw, you might not remember this, but we did see this, these initiatives were facilitated and encouraged by the King of Poland, Augustus, although in this case he was acting in his capacity as the Elector of Saxony, and he waited for his Polish subjects to ratify the Treaty of Vienna in their same. This Treaty of Vienna would pretty much solidify and cement the existence of this Northern League against Russia, so it was very important that the same ratified it. This same was due to convene in January 1720, and it would be during the course of this same that the destiny of the North would be decided. If the Commonwealth approved the Treaty of Vienna and agreed to join Hanover and the Holy Roman Emperor, then other powers would surely follow suit, as they had already been invited to join. The treaty was a bold move, and, despite what its supporters publicly claimed, it was a direct snub in the direction of Russia. As per that treaty's demands, the Allies would insist that Russia evacuate the Polish-Lithuanian Commonwealth of her soldiers, which she had done to some extent by early 1720. It also demanded that as the price of peace with Sweden, Russia would have to hand back its Baltic conquests, apart from St. Petersburg. The mutual defence aspects of the Treaty of Vienna were also aimed at the Russians, as well as the Prussians, who were feared to be acting in tandem against the interests of the Holy Roman Emperor and George I's northern sphere of influence. In the last few months of 1719, though, Georgian diplomacy managed to separate all of Peter's allies through separate agreements with Prussians, Danes, and Saxons. It was a really fascinating turn of events, so listen to episode 16 if you want to look at that diplomacy again and re-jog your memories. George had made peace with the Swedes in November 1719, and every other member of the anti-Swedish League then followed suit. These separate peace agreements were made possible because of a very important development. King Charles XII of Sweden was no longer in power. He had died, so that was basically the reason why, but he had also been replaced by his sister Ulrika and her husband Frederick of Hesse. This new regime was then determined to come to an accord with every member of the anti-Swedish League, whatever it took, with the main boogeyman of Russia being held out for the moment. As it stood in January 1720, Russia and Sweden were the last two members of the war still hostile to one another, and while Peter still had an alliance with Prussia, neither Prussia nor any other power was content to act now in the region until they saw what happened next. And by what happened next, they meant keeping their eyes on Poland. The real litmus test of Georgian diplomacy would be in Poland. If the Polish-Lithuanian Commonwealth ratified the Treaty of Vienna during their same, then this anti-Russian alliance would almost certainly be built upon in the years to come, and Sweden might even be granted better opportunities at the peace table with Russia in the wider European interest of the balance of power. A lot, you could say, was riding on this 1720 same, and that's where we're going to resume our story from. I'm going to take you to January 1720, so I hope you're ready for this. Thanks so much again for supporting this show and ensuring that When Diplomacy Fails is where history thrives. Now let's get into this. The Commonwealth Sejm, which assembled at the northern city of Grodno in January 1720, was perhaps the most weighted gathering of the Republic's nobles since the Silent Sejm 3 years before. The Silent Sejm is an event we haven't looked at in too much detail. We've only really mentioned it in passing, but rest assured we will get back to it. So just keep the Silent Sejm of 1717 in your mind for the moment, just in the background, and rest assured we will look at it. But it hadn't ended Polish sovereignty, and it hadn't guaranteed Russian overlordship either. The Commonwealth nobles that gathered for the Sejm in 1720 were in no doubts about their legal and legislative independence, but it would be wrong to suggest that no member of the Sejm had any doubts about another struggle waging both outside and within their Diet's walls. For the better part of 2 years, you see, diplomatic initiatives had been pursued by both the agents of Hanover and the agents of Russia, with the aim of either separating from or securing the Commonwealth to its Russian ally. For several years, the status of the Commonwealth and of Russia had seemed secure. Augustus and Peter, it seemed, the king and the Tsar, had a friendship which ensured Russo-Polish friendship in turn. But the last few years, in particular the last few years of the 17-teens, if that makes sense, had proved that nothing could be taken for granted. King Augustus, for his part, had discovered the potential his position granted for greater independence and expansion of his powers. While he had never viewed Peter as an enemy, he began to think outside of the perfect friendship that had granted him so many fortunes up to this point. He need not betray his patron, the Tsar. He need only place his realm in a position of strength from which it could acquire the greatest concessions and advantages from both his rivals and the Tsar. And the Treaty of Vienna gave Augustus the best chance to achieve these ends. Neither the Holy Roman Emperor nor the Elector King of Britain, Hanover, seemed so interested in the fortunes or stance of the Commonwealth in so many years. To Augustus, it was clear that the Treaty of Vienna needed Polish acquiescence to work, and that without the Commonwealth's adherence to the treaty, the entire venture would be a dead letter. Augustus's sudden change of heart as he went from determined ally of the Tsar to multi-layered character has been a hard turn to explain. It's not entirely clear whether, after the silent same in spring 1717, Augustus seems to have realised he could never be free to rule the Commonwealth unless the Tsar's influence was absent, or if he simply got it into his head that great rewards would be his if he made his allegiance a bit more murky and uncertain. By refusing to declare against the Tsar, he could elicit more promises and guarantees from the Treaty of Vienna group in the hope that he someday would. On the other hand, though, by signing the Treaty of Vienna in his capacity as Elector of Saxony, he sent a message to the Tsar that he was more than capable of pursuing his own foreign policy and securing his own interests. Augustus was perhaps the major character of Polish politics for three decades, and understanding his position, his motives, or his actual end goals is a task which becomes more difficult as the decades progressed. In my view, Augustus is really in need of an English language, for my sake really, an English language biography which puts his era and his reign in context properly. Typically enough, when it comes to Polish history, all this stuff is really underrepresented in the English language. So any of you enthusiasts out there who might be particularly proficient in Polish, head on over to the Polish archives and help a brother out if you don't mind. In any case, it is easier to divide his guiding principles into three categories depending on the decade in question, so that's what I'm going to do now. It tidies things up a bit. Between 1700 to 1710, Augustus was focused on securing his Polish crown and defeating the Swedes. Fair enough, because King Charles XII was so freaking strong and so dangerous to Polish independence. Between 1710 to 1720, Augustus was more focused on consolidating his reign in Poland after his previous abdication, and towards the end of that decade, as Sweden became weaker, he became occupied with the task of improving his overall powers and position in the face of any opposition, be it from Russia or the West. Between 1720 to 1730, as we'll see, Augustus's thoughts would turn to his succession and how he was going to persuade the Poles that it would be in their best interests to appoint his son as his successor. It's been said before, but it should be said again, that the Poles were immensely suspicious of their king. And I don't just mean of King Augustus, I mean of virtually all the kings they had. The Polish nobility tended to be very suspicious of them. They interpreted any attempt to make the crown hereditary as an attempt to also make it absolutist and counter to its elective traditions. The nobility of the Commonwealth would thus go to any lengths to jealously protect their privileges, which essentially meant they would go to any lengths to ensure that nobody could tell them what to do. We explained the motives of the Commonwealth nobles in the last episode, and in many ways it's difficult and unwieldy to talk about the Commonwealth's different noble families and what motivated them, since it wasn't merely the nobles that could vote, and since the dispositions of the different noble families varied wildly across the Commonwealth's expanse, and the Polish-Lithuanian Commonwealth was massive. In the same way, it feels really unwieldy to constantly have to refer to that realm as a Commonwealth, when I really just want to talk about Poles, but all of these points, whether it's just me that feels them or not, speaks to a wider point about the Polish-Lithuanian Commonwealth as a whole, which would later become critically important as the 18th century progressed. The Commonwealth, the Republic, whatever you want to call it, was a polity quite unlike any other in 18th century Europe, or before 18th century Europe. This republic was the outcome of a series of conflicting and powerful cultural and political trends which few in Europe cared for or understood. The Commonwealth's very uniqueness as a state seemed to make it weak. It was not absolutist like the Russian or French monarchies. The nobles had too much power, but not enough power to replicate the British Westminster system and have it both ways. It was like a bag of divisive and contradictory laws and regulations in perhaps the most strategically important part of the continent at the time. As a state, It could not mobilize or defend itself like others could, and as a kingdom, it would not obey its king or carry out his orders as other kingdoms could. In previous centuries, at least before the 17th century, these idiosyncrasies ensured a Polish golden age in culture and commerce and trade and art and everything else was able to happen. And Polish power flourished at the centre of the continent. Following some really unfortunate wars and some very bad kings, though, by the earlier part of the 18th century, the factors which had once made Poland so wonderful were now making it seem more and more like an anomaly, an alien state, and something which could be taken advantage of by its neighbours. In the second half of the 18th century, these factors didn't just make it weak, but dangerous, and the anarchy of which the Commonwealth's nobility seemed so proud was a recipe for instability and rebellion within its lands and those of its neighbours. Such dangers were certainly exaggerated, but the very idea that a divided, confused, and weak republic was bordering the powerful absolutist states of Austria, Prussia, and Russia by the middle of the century proved to be justification for annexation and later partition. It's important to understand these points and the trajectory of our narrative as well, because all of these are themes we'll return to, but it's also worth alluding to them here, since it reminds us what kind of state was gathering its varied forces together for that very important Sejm in January 1720, as is typical for the time when it comes to gathering all the nobles in one place. Nothing was ever straightforward. Giving this bit of background is also important because it's in this episode we see the first reference to external guarantees couched in a language not of interference, but of protection. After 6 months, Russian and Prussian negotiations had produced a mutual agreement whereby the two states would conspire to prevent the passing of the Treaty of Vienna by the Polish Sejm, while they would also commit to the prevention of an absolutist Saxon monarchy in Poland at the same time. Of course, they couldn't present their intentions as realistically an attempt to have their way in Poland, so the Russo-Prussian delegation presented their opposition to the Treaty of Vienna in the latter terms. The Treaty of Vienna wasn't dangerous, they said, because it would isolate Russia, draw the Commonwealth closer to better allies in the West, or would empower the Commonwealth to pursue its own policy. Oh no, you see, dear Polish nobles, the Treaty of Vienna was dangerous because deep down, what King Augustus really wanted was to increase his own powers and establish an absolute monarchy with himself at the top. This was the favourite piece of fake news given by the Russo-Prussian delegation, and it struck such a chord with a sizable block of the Sejm because of the old fears and jealousies for their rights and freedoms that the nobles all possessed. What was more, Augustus had not done himself many favours to dispel these fears in the years before the Sejm met. We saw last time how a marriage approved by Augustus led to his son marrying the daughter of the Holy Roman Emperor. This Saxon-Habsburg marriage could be passed off relatively easily as one which represented Augustus grasping for more royal legitimacy and power with the aim of bringing his son into line as successor. It was immensely suggestive to try and appoint one's successor while they still lived. To do so suggested absolutist intentions and a disrespect of the Commonwealth's constitution. In the middle of the 17th century, King John Casimir faced such opposition when he tried to announce his successor, and the nobles rebelled against him. This led to a ruinous civil war for over 5 years in the 1660s, at a time when the Commonwealth could least afford it. John Casimir had wanted his heir named in his lifetime because he wanted to avoid the fractious and divisive prospect of an election, which would paralyze the Commonwealth temporarily and make it vulnerable to outside interference so long as the election went on. All of this was true and John Casimir's intentions seem reasonable enough, but a glaring problem with the Commonwealth's lauded institutions was that many of its tenets, such as the principle of elective monarchy, never figured for the impact of foreign intervention into its noble intentions. It was taken for granted, for instance, that an elective monarchy was the best way to ensure the liberty of the nobility and prevent the establishment of absolutism. Think of the early Roman Republic's fear of monarchy, and you'll sort of see what the Poles were afraid of here. The Poles didn't fear monarchy, but the Polish nobility feared a monarchy that they couldn't control. In designing this well-intentioned check on royal power all the way back in the 1570s when the first elected Polish king was elected, it never seemed to occur to any of the magnates assembled that opportunistic rivals surrounding the Commonwealth would seek to prey upon or interfere in the whole process for their own interests. All of these processes, the act of electing a king, the fact that the Polish nobles were afraid of absolutism, it all seemed to exist in this bubble where nothing outside the bubble seemed to matter, no matter how dangerous those events happening outside of the bubble were to Polish independence. By 1720, these problems had become even worse. The elective monarchy had become an honoured established principle, one which was as sacred to the Commonwealth as its Catholicism. There was absolutely no question of changing the system, of reducing the powers of the nobles, or of altering its elective nature. At the same time, although it had been in place for 150 years, there seemed no realization that the elective monarchy had inherently damaged the Commonwealth far more often than it had ensured its safety. Since that damage was not always necessarily self-inflicted, but came from the opportunism and predatory instincts of the Republic's neighbours, even if the nobles had properly taken note of the costs of this elective monarchy system, they may well have concluded that the system was not flawed, even if the world in which it existed was. Bearing all this in mind, it doesn't just set us up well for our story in this episode, it also pretty much presents the two sides of the debate when it comes down to really answering the question of why Poland collapsed in the first place. Was it because of the Polish system of government, and that system being unfit for purpose from the beginning? Or was it because of Poland's neighbours invading and interfering when they had no real right to? You could argue that it was a mixture of both, but at the time, it was very hard to take a step back if you lived in Poland and argue for one side or the other. In September 1719, a few months before the Sejm was due to meet, Augustus met several important Commonwealth nobles in his Saxon home of Dresden. Conversation was all about the Treaty of Vienna, what form it would take, and whether it would be approved in January's Sejm. Some of the assembled potentates were angry at Augustus. This treaty had, after all, been negotiated behind their backs, without their consent, and Augustus had signed it only in his capacity as elector. They were now being asked as Commonwealth citizens to approve a treaty they had never seen or had any hand in. The suspicions that this whole process had been engineered so that Poland's nobility would never see the secret articles of the treaty created real tension. As we saw, there were several secret articles. These included mutual defense agreements and plans for several contingencies, not declarations binding the signatories to install Augustus as an absolute monarch. But at the same time, Augustus couldn't reveal what the secret articles of the Treaty of Vienna were, and he also couldn't give them a straight answer when they pestered him for information on whether there were, in fact, any secret articles at all. Placed on the spot, surrounded by Commonwealth nobles who were themselves far from home, the sense of vulnerability that these nobles felt was only aggravated when Augustus startled the Polish senators and ministers of state assembled at Dresden by declaring that in order to complete the salutary task of providing the Republic with friends capable of protecting her, it remained only for the Council of State to declare Poland's adhesion to the Treaty of Vienna. The senators protested. They could not possibly usurp the functions of a general diet. They couldn't approve the Treaty of Vienna until the Sejm had voted on it back in Grodno. "Then you are doomed," King Augustus retorted. And this only served to set off a heated discussion about the validity of a treaty which had been entered into without the Republic's prior knowledge or approval. As a meeting, you could say it didn't go well, and it also boded ill for the Sejm's ruling in the new year. The French envoy to Dresden reported that The Poles saw themselves as a man trapped in a lion's den and liable to be mauled to death on making the slightest movement. It was pointless to ask them whether they would like to be set free, for any indication to that effect could be fatal. Anyone wanting to come to their rescue must offer them an outlet and a chance of using it with impunity. It also didn't help that Tsar Peter was no dummy, and he was fully aware of Augustus's blundering. He added to his frenemy's woes by making it clear to the Poles that Russia possessed an army of over 200,000 men, spread through Kiev and the border, and that 50,000 Cossacks on his command would sweep through the Commonwealth lands like a terrible wind. Caught between their king's overbearing blunders and their neighbours' fearsome threats, the Commonwealth, which assembled its nobles in January 1720, had an awful lot to ponder over. Even while there was much to fear from Russia, the threats of the Russian and Prussian envoys at first made very little impact. A large block of nobles were angry at incidents that could be traced back several years. Some were quite reasonably annoyed that the Russians had devastated their lands during their scorched earth policy a decade before in the war against the late Swedish king. Others were annoyed that during the Åland Islands Conference, the Russian delegation had refused to allow any Polish participation. Others were angrier still that the Russians had taken so long to evacuate the Commonwealth, and that when they had, they stole, burned, and destroyed several farms, villages, and manors. Some demanded compensation for these woes, and demanded also that Russia return large portions of its Baltic conquests to Sweden. Already, these nobles had been informed by the Swedish government, as per Georgian prodding, that the German dependencies around Pomerania would be handed back to the Commonwealth, and this meant they were not displeased to sacrifice the Baltic possessions in return. It was entirely possible that these losses would be made up later with further Russian concessions. Particularly, some Baltic pieces that the Tsar had, after all, once promised to Augustus, if you can remember back to before the Great Northern War, actually erupted. Courland, that duchy of the Polish crown, was also a sensitive issue, since several Russian contingents still resided there. Furthermore, this block of nobles believed that their king was right. For all his faults, only through joining with the Treaty of Vienna could the Commonwealth's interests be secured. Their position was one of defiance, and under advice from Georgian agents, they attempted to put steel into their comrades by reasoning that the Tsar would not dare invade the Commonwealth with a hostile army, so they consequently held the high ground. The other side of the argument was then presented. Supported by the Russo-Prussian envoys and egged on by the Tsar's threats, it soon became apparent that the treaty would not be ratified. The major stumbling block to its ratification was not the fear that the nobles had of Augustus's true intentions, though these did feature in the debate as we'll see. The real issue, and one which James Scott, George's envoy to the same, noticed, was that the Commonwealth nobles would only go so far in their opposition to the Tsar. While the Georgian initiatives had worked wonders, and had detached several of the Tsar's allies from his side, sowed discord among them, and ensured that Russia was the only one left fighting Sweden, these initiatives couldn't persuade the Commonwealth to approve of yet another war, a war in which they would shoulder the main burden, in which their lands would be subject to a Russian invasion, and which they would be forced to rely upon distant allies if they wanted to win. What was more, as much as they feared the impact of a Russian invasion, they also feared that while this invasion was being tackled, Augustus would swoop in and claim that in order to fight the war, he would need greater powers than he already had. Thus, the king would be one step closer to achieving the absolutism which was so feared. Or as the ambassador, James Scott, put it, "These lords believe that a war would expose their nakedness or give occasion to their king to practice upon the liberty of their constitution, which they suppose he might do in case of a rupture with the Muscovites." Augustus's behaviour to this point had shown that he was often impatient with the Commonwealth's rules, coming as he did from absolutist rule in Saxony. Although he had repeatedly insisted that he did not desire to see the Commonwealth's elective monarchy replaced with an absolutist one, he was already thinking of how to install his son as heir. This puzzle for Augustus was probably palpable in his actions. It would have been hard for the elector to declare his loyalty to the Commonwealth's constitution without any reservations if deep down, what he really wanted to do was undermine it to the point of denying an election and having his own son placed there instead. He may not have wanted his son to rule Poland as an absolutist monarch, but he did want to ensure his succession, and in the minds of the Republic's nobles, that was bad enough, and it was reason enough to oppose his designs. Suspicions of their king, the simple application of Russian money, and the argument that it was time for the Commonwealth to stop having to endure foreign wars for foreign interests also played a role. Thanks to the Russo-Prussian argument made public during this time that they were acting to prevent the ratification of the Treaty of Vienna because they wished to ensure that Augustus never established an absolute monarchy, the anti-Russian bloc of the Sejm was, unfortunately in my view, gradually overcome. On the 23rd of February 1720, the Sejm broke up after determining that the Treaty of Vienna was against the interests of the Commonwealth. There is an awful lot of what-ifs we could ask in this question. Augustus might have lamented that the Commonwealth didn't know what was good for it, and that its unwarranted fears and concerns doomed it to foreign supplication. Indeed, the coup achieved by the Russo-Prussian initiative ended any threat that the Treaty of Vienna might have posed to the Tsar. It also marked the beginning of the end of Polish independence, we might say. As L. R. Lewiter in his article, Poland, Russia and the Treaty of Vienna, noted, "The mutual pledge, the first of many, to preserve Poland's archaic and anarchic constitution, amended to a declaration of intent to eliminate the Republic from European politics." If the silent Sejm of 1717 provided a stark example of how far the Commonwealth's stock had fallen, it was this virtually unknown Sejm in early 1720 that essentially ended the prospect of Polish resurgence. Having stated their fears of the day, it was clear that the old and chaotic Commonwealth constitution was now standing in the way of the Republic's security. Yet, those in charge of changing or reforming it busied themselves not with the dangers posed by their external enemies, but with debating their own king's supposedly nefarious intentions. By fearing the rumoured ambitions of their king, they left themselves hopelessly vulnerable to the machinations of two genuinely dangerous and actually absolutist powers, the Prussian king and, above all, the Russian Tsar. This 1720 Sejm put the kibosh on another plan too, the development of the Treaty of Vienna into an officially anti-Russian league. If the Commonwealth had ratified and properly joined itself to the treaty, then the other concerned powers would surely have followed suit. In September 1719, Sweden's new regime had developed a plan whereby a coalition force of 70,000 would meet in Royal Prussia, make their way east, and pick up new forces from the neighbouring German princes, including Frederick William of Brandenburg, Prussia. Yet, in return for Prussia's agreement to cooperate with the Russians in preventing the Treaty of Vienna, the Tsar committed to guarantee Prussia's gains in its war with Sweden, gains which included Stettin. Last time, we saw that in late 1719, Georgian initiatives seemed to separate Prussia from Russia. Much to the Tsar's chagrin, Frederick William discovered that he loved the idea of Stettin more than the idea of an exclusive alliance with Russia. The Georgian initiatives assumed that Peter would be too miffed at these agreements to ever look at Frederick William the same way again, and Frederick William thought this too. Yet George and even Augustus underestimated Peter's tenacity and perception. Understanding their expectations, Peter simply let the matter go, and he approached Frederick William again as a friend with this new deal. A new alliance between Prussia and Russia was then agreed upon, making it impossible for the Treaty of Vienna to be further expanded. This is further explained by Lewiter when he noted, "In March 1720, Frederick William I declared that he would not help Sweden to recover from the Tsar any of her former territories and would not intervene to the detriment of Russia in the event of the continuation of the Northern War. The alternative possibility of shipping a Swedish army across to Courland was seen to be impracticable once it became clear that Sweden had lost faith in the effectiveness of an attack on Russia, for which, in any case, she lacked the necessary resources. From this moment, at the latest, any plans for driving the Tsar from the Baltic at the 11th hour should have been dismissed as illusory. Yet, George would not give up, sending a far larger naval squadron to the Baltic in March 1720. This arrived in May, and Sir John Norris, its commander, received written orders from the attending envoy in Stockholm, where Norris dropped anchor. In comparison to the previous years, it was now clear that Norris had been given hostile orders when it came to dealing with the Russians. Now that all were at peace, save Russia and Sweden, and considering the Anglo-Swedish alliance, it seemed entirely possible that George intended to provoke a war with Russia, which would drag the concerned powers in through force and coercion after the diplomatic efforts had evidently failed in the earlier part of the year. We only need to look at the ambassador's written orders to see what the story was. The British ambassador's written orders were given on the 23rd of May 1720, and they read as follows. Sir John Norris, it is now in your power, by the help of God, to do the most signal piece of service to your country that any man has done in his age. The scales of the North are in your hand. If the Tsar refuses the King's mediation, as he probably will, a mark of which will be his continuing hostility to Sweden, I hope you will, by force of arms, bring him to reason and destroy that fleet, which will disturb the world. God bless you, Sir John Norris. All honest and good men will give you applause. Many persons will envy you, and nobody will dare say a word against you. Every Englishman will be obliged to you if you can destroy the Tsar's fleet, which I don't doubt you will do. By forcibly arbitrating the war between Russia and Sweden, George intended to ensure that Peter would not acquire the crushing peace he desired. Although the diplomatic initiative had evidently failed in the previous months, British naval power and prestige spoke for itself, and the Tsar would not be able to afford a new war with a far better prepared and provisioned enemy. Britain was too important and too powerful to ignore, and yet George had certainly exaggerated when he sent these orders to Norris through his Swedish envoy. The average Englishman cared not a jot for Sweden, and only agitated against Russia when Britain's economic or naval position seemed under attack. In 1718, we remember that George had been able to make this appear to be the case when he emphasised the plight of Gdansk and the threat that the Russians had posed to British interests there. Yet, by spring 1720, the Russians had evacuated the Commonwealth and no longer posed any discernible threat to Britain, at least not one that the people or government in London were interested in. Because of this, aside from a few considerable Russophobes in the British cabinet, there was no appreciation for Peter's explosion in power, and there was only a desire for a final peace in the North, whatever form it took. In fairness, after all, the Great Northern War had gone on for 20 years by this point, and everyone was sick of the Baltic trade being disrupted because of it. The Swedish alliance was not wholly popular, and the anti-Russian policy was beginning to be seen only as the demand of a German king upon the British people. George, indeed, was soon to discover the true limits of his power. Contrary to Norris's letter, the scales of the North did not lie in his hands, but in the hands of the triumphant Tsar. For a brief, fleeting moment, these scales had seemed to rest in the hands of the Commonwealth. Their decision would guarantee either a change in Polish foreign policy or a reversion to more of the same. Russian pressures and fears had ensured that the latter outcome had won out, and now, as spring led into summer, this was made official. In May 1720, Augustus informed the courts of Vienna, London, and Stockholm that he valued their efforts in the interests of the pacification of the North, but being bound by the terms of the Russo-Polish alliance, he must consult the Tsar before associating himself with their action. This, as everyone appreciated at the time, was a diplomatic way of saying that Augustus's attempts to wrest more freedom of action and leverage for himself and the Commonwealth had failed, and consequently, he would be returning to his old policy of staying in the Tsar's good books. The following month, he called upon the residents of the Tsar's envoy to do just that, while over the summer of 1720, the nobles in the Commonwealth began to repair their relationships with the Russians, who were themselves eager to welcome their valuable friends back. As they returned to their old parasitic friendships, The Commonwealth nobles were congratulated by the Russians for having defeated their king's efforts to subvert their freedoms and liberties, while the Poles thanked the Russians for guaranteeing their broken constitution. From such performances, it was clear what had happened. The Commonwealth nobles had indeed held the scales of the North in their hands, yet in the space of a political session, they had willingly handed these scales back to their increasingly overbearing neighbour. With that, the trend was set for the rest of the Commonwealth's existence, and the 18th century's most infamous example of Stockholm Syndrome had begun. Next time, we'll finally bring the Great Northern War to an end, and examine how the reconciled Augustus and his old friend Peter aimed to celebrate the overturning of the balance of power and the confirmation of a Russian supremacy. Until then, this has been Poland Is Not Yet Lost. You've been a wonderful patron, and I have been Zach. Thanks so much for listening and supporting this show, guys, and I'll be seeing you all soon.